Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Baltimore, Maryland. I see you out there, and I appreciate your support. Let's get started. Welcome back to Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about a listener email. We're going to talk about a retracted study. We're going to do a quick hit on a couple articles that I'm reading and I thought were interesting. I'm not going to go super in depth. I'm just going to kind of maybe give you the nuts and butts and guts of a couple articles. But with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good. Hold on. Wait one second. Before I get into the intro music, if you are listening to this right now, please hit stop. Stop what you're doing. And please give this podcast a 5-star review on Stitcher or iTunes. It really does help. And if you've previously given a 5-star review sometime outside of the last month, well, I got to tell you, we could really use it again. And by we, I mean I, because this is just a one-man band. This is just a solo show. This is just a one guy with a top hat just trying to do it all. So if you could please, before the intro music, just go ahead, give a 5-star review. It takes 5 seconds of your time, and I promise you, you will learn more than 5 seconds worth of knowledge in this podcast. So with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing. And I know it is a pain to give a 5-star recommendation. I get it. I understand. It's a delay in what you want to do, which is get down to the articles at hand. But with your 5-star recommendation, it makes it easier for other people to find the podcast. The easier it is for other people to find it, the more people that will listen, and the more we can spread the word. So really, don't think about it as giving a 5-star recommendation. Think about it as making sure the rest of the world, the rest of the medical community is up to date as you are and is also questioning medicine just like you. And with that, without further ado, let's jump right into it. We're going to get first to a listener email. Now, remember, you can email me anytime you want. I will always send you articles that you need to read or that you want to read. I'll answer any of your questions. Andrew Bilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. This listener question was from Brian. I'm not going to go with his last name. There was a long email, but the one email that he said, or one part of the email that he talked about, was two podcasts ago when we talked about antibiotic resistance, how it's a real thing, how we in medicine just kind of make up the length of antibiotics. It's going to be either 5 days because that's how many fingers we have. It's going to be 7 days because that's how many days in a week. It's going to be 10 days because that's how many fingers are on both hands. Or it's going to be 14 days because that's 2 weeks. It's not that 9 days wasn't effective or 13 days wasn't effective. It's not that 4 days couldn't work or 6 days is just this magical no man land that no one recommends. It's just that those are the easy numbers that we always recommend, and you're likely going to recommend however many days to however many patients based on however many days and however many patients you've previously recommended. You just continue to do what you continue to do. And looking at the evidence, it's not always based on guidelines, even though the guidelines are also just made up on made up recommended days of 5, 7, 10, and 14. But in this email, he says, the one on antibiotics was also very interesting. I wonder, since we keep making up various prescription lengths, if there should be a better way to see how long somebody needs to take the antibiotics. For example, I know for some colds, people recommended to take Tylenol until they are 24 hours without a fever, not on the Tylenol. Maybe something based on that, where once the person feels better, we recommend them taking antibiotics for 1 or 2 more days and then just go ahead and stop taking the antibiotics. This would help then the patient fight off the disease and the illness. He goes on to say that maybe some people need antibiotics for otitis media for 3 days, or maybe some need it for 5 days based on their ability to fight off infection. And then basically he finishes up saying maybe that if we change this length of prescribing to as needed, this would cut down on antibiotic resistance. There are multiple things. Brian, if you were not with us back Questioning Medicine 51, I would encourage you go back all the way back now to episode 51, almost 100 episodes ago, where I talk about this very issue. And that is, antibiotic resistance is real. We make up these days at random. And realistically, Once the patient feels better, they should go ahead and stop the antibiotics. In fact, we are contributing more to antibiotic resistance by telling our patients, take your antibiotics completely as prescribed. Don't stop one day early. That is leading to more antibiotic resistance in the evidence than just telling them, take the antibiotic till you feel well, and then you can stop taking the antibiotic. I will tell you that I personally tell my patients all the time, take the antibiotic till you feel well, maybe take another day of it, and then go ahead and stop the antibiotic. But I almost always give them the guideline recommended dose of antibiotics just in case they don't get feeling well until the end of their antibiotics. But when I'm talking to the patient, when I'm educating the patient, I almost always tell them, take the antibiotics till you feel well, take maybe one more day, and then you can go ahead and stop the antibiotics, because that is what the evidence does. And I don't know what patient's going to feel better from pneumonia after 2 days of antibiotics and which patient's going to feel better after 3 or 4 or 5. So I'm always hesitant to just, here, you only need 2 days of antibiotics because 2 days of antibiotics is likely when you're going to feel better. Well, it is likely when you're going to feel better, but it's not the overall end-all be-all answer. So I give them the full guideline recommended dose, and then I tell them, stop taking it when you feel better. Brian, thank you for emailing in, and go back and listen, episode 51. I thought it was one of my best. I'm just kidding. It was probably not one of my best at all, but it was an interesting one, and hopefully you will also find it interesting. Now, moving on to a topic that I'm going to just barely touch on. I don't even want to talk about it for very long because it literally makes me sick. It is based on the old saying that a lie can travel around the world before the truth even gets out of bed and puts its shoes on in the morning. And that was clearly seen in The Lancet many, many, many years ago with Andrew Wakefield. That is the physician that had his license completely stripped of him. The physician that had a private company that was set up to sue pharmaceutical companies for their vaccines. The physician who was the lead author on the paper that got published in The Lancet that said, vaccines cause autism. And now here we are 30 years later, and there are still people who believe that vaccines cause autism, even though this was clearly a fraud, even though when they went back and they looked at the 12 patients that were in this study, it was very clear that the vaccine did not cause the autism. You almost couldn't even correlate the two. I mean, it was like the person got the vaccine and then 7 years later had autism. The person got the vaccine and then never actually was diagnosed with autism. It is that one study that has been retracted, that has caused Andrew Wakefield to lose his medical license. It is that one study that still has individuals today saying vaccines cause autism, which is why I am so sad to see once again in The Lancet a paper that has recently been retracted. This paper is titled Hydroxychloroquine or Chloroquine with or without a macrolide for treatment of COVID-19, a multinational registry analysis. I was going to talk about this paper anyways because how could I not? I mean, it is the largest observational study ever published on hydroxychloroquine. It is over 96,000 hospitalized COVID-19 patients from an international registry comparing 671 hospitals on 6 continents. I mean, OMG. If you're going to talk about the big kahuna, this so far was it on hydroxychloroquine. And their outcome was hydroxychloroquine was no better than placebo, and in fact, it might have been worse. It might have caused more deaths, except the problem, the reason it's been retracted is because it's a fraud. It is not real. The authors that were on it went to the company who produced this data and said, hey, we actually, now that this is being raised as a fuss, we, the authors, want to see this data that you gave us. How did you get this data that you gave us? Because we have this data, now everyone out there is calling us a fraud, and we didn't think we were a fraud because you gave us the information. We trusted that you were telling us the truth. And then the company that goes by the name Surgifier or Surgisphere said, no, we will not give over any of our information. We can't give over any of our information because we've made agreements, you see, with these hospitals, these almost 700 some hospitals, we've made agreements with them that we will not release any of the information. So sorry, you actually can't see any of our data. We're not going to show you any of our patient population. We're not going to show you how we got this data. We're just going to say we have the data and you should trust us. But the problem with trusting them is that in this Lancet paper, they reported more deaths from COVID-19 in Australia than Australia authorities reported. So one of two things is true. Either Australia authorities are lying and they're underreporting their deaths, which is possible, or this paper, Surgisphere, is making up their data and has more deaths just included in because that's what they decided to go ahead and make up. Also more likely possible. And here's the other problem. If you're going to make up your data, don't make up your data worse than what is being reported in the public. I mean, that just throws a black eye on you. You know people are going to be looking, being like, wait a second, you are saying that there's 500 deaths here, and the United States of America is only saying that we have 250 deaths. Where are you finding the 250 deaths that the United States of America's health population is not finding? Where did this come from? And then it's in the Lancet. It should have been peer-reviewed, except for the Lancet saying, well, we're not saying it's peer-reviewed or was not peer-reviewed, and we're not going to release the names of the people that was peer-reviewed. And there is one belief out there that the Lancet editor-in-chief, Richard Horton, who absolutely hates Donald Trump, I mean, he has came out and said, I don't like Donald Trump, well, that maybe, just maybe, he let this paper slip through the cracks because this goes against hydroxychloroquine. President Trump, as we all know, has come out and said, I think hydroxychloroquine works and I take it myself prophylactically. Whether that's true or not true, I'm not going to say because I don't think we have evidence at this point. I mean, all the evidence we have says that it probably does not work, but we really don't have the gold standard for it. And to let this slip through the crack, let this lie slip through the crack is a major problem. One, because it's a lie. People read this, believe this, and all major trials on hydroxychloroquine were put to a halt. A randomized control trial for hydroxychloroquine with COVID-19 was put to a halt because of the release of this paper. We in science are basing our next results, our next studies, our next tests on the previous individuals before us being honest. On the previous individuals before us not falsifying their data so we can use their data and say, well, we know that that didn't work, so let's try something else. But when people can just falsify, make up, throw in whatever numbers they want at random on their numbers and say, oh, this is the results we found, well, that throws it off for generations to come. Not only generations of scientists to come, but generations of individuals who will read the original report, like vaccines and autism, and never actually follow up on the retraction, never actually follow up on what the data actually says. This type of science, this type of literature makes me sick. And with that, let's get into some articles that might actually contribute to patient care. Okay, let's get into some articles that will actually maybe change your practice or interest you in the slightest. Naloxone, let's talk about it. Naloxone is used to treat opioid overdose. Naloxone can save lives. We know this. We all know that, but you have to give it early because if you don't, well, then the patient will be dead by the time you eventually give it. But what if we made it over the counter? That would be awesome. It'd be easy for people to get. But in order to make it available over the counter, you have to have an easy instructions, like with Motrin, 1 to 2 pills every 6 hours, not to exceed 10 pills in 24 hours. But how do you write instructions for naloxone that make it easy for the common man or the common woman to understand? I have never thought about this kind of study, but it was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine titled FDA Initiative for Drug Facts Label for Over-the-Counter Naloxone. They asked 710 participants what the instructions meant, and then the primary endpoint corresponded to the participants understanding the key steps in the naloxone administration as depicted on the label. The label was easy to read for medical professionals, but for the common man, it could have been a little harder. And it included things like, check the patient and see if they're responsive. Give the medication. Call 911 immediately. Stay with the patient till EMS arrives. And mainly everyone got all the details correct and would only mess up because when tested on this, they would say, call 911 and not say, call 911 immediately. They missed out the immediately, which was a subtle undertone, but they did miss it. So overall, the FDA in this found that the label that they gave was adequate for the use in the development of naloxone product intended for over-the-counter sales, which is exciting. This is great news because the medication should be available over-the-counter. it is easy for everyone to get. It needs to be easily accessible for everyone to pick up. I know that we as providers should always be prescribing naloxone to anyone who gets opiates, because it's not the people who intend to overdose on opiates, it's the people who accidentally overdose on opiates that we should be concerned about. And that realistically is almost everyone who's prescribed opiates. If they overdose, it was an accidental overdose, not an intentional overdose. So the reversal agent should be available for everyone. Now, some people need reminders to do just about everything, but I am not one of those people. You can ask my wife. I only need one reminder to clean up my entire room, not leave my shoes in the middle of the floor, not have my dirty laundry hanging outside the dirty laundry hamper. The better brain will tell you I am fantastic when it comes to only tell me once and I do it, well, maybe I do or don't do it, but I might also fit in with this study titled Effect of Patient Portal Reminders Sent by Healthcare System on Influenza Vaccination Rates, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This is a randomized clinical trial of, listen to this, almost 165,000 patients in 52 primary care practices, and they looked to see if reminders sent through the patient portal increased influenza vaccination rates. Patients were randomized into one of four groups. You either didn't get a reminder, you got one reminder, you got two reminders, or you got three reminders. And the primary outcome was the number of individuals that had an influenza vaccine documented in the electronic health record. Well, if you didn't get a reminder to get your flu shot, then the rates of flu shot in that group was 37.5%. If you got one reminder, the rates of the flu shot was 38%. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it went up by half of a percent. And if you got two reminders, the rates of vaccination was 38.2%. And if you got three reminders, then the vaccination rate was still 38.2%. There was no change whether you got two reminders or three reminders. So the rest of the individuals who were just going to hit delete on that email that came into them, delete on that reminder that came into them, they were going to hit delete no matter probably how many reminders you really sent them. It didn't matter. They were just going to hit delete. The bad news here is that it is only a 0.5 increase with one reminder and a total of a 0.7 increase with two reminders, but it could be worse. At least we're getting something. It appears also that you don't get a lot of bang for your buck with the extra reminders. Again, going from two to three was no difference at all. And just like those annoying postal cards from Bed Bath & Beyond or Bath & Body Works or whatever they were, that you know what I'm talking about, the 12 by 19 cardboard cards that we get in the mail, most of these notifications are ignored and thrown in the trash. So even though the gain was very minimal, 0.7%, overall, this is a difference. This is close, but not close to either a half or a 1%, depending how you want to look at it and depending how you want to do your rounding, of a percent of individuals actually getting the flu shot. And this did reach statistical significance, but that's probably not the most important part. The most important part is, does it reach clinical significance? To me, yes, it does. It does reach clinical significance if this can be automatically implemented in your electronic medical record. If it electronic medical record, let's say on December 1st, sends the first reminder to everyone without you really having to do anything. You hit a button and it automatically sends it to all your patients. And then on January 1st, let's say, or another time frame down the road, it automatically sends a second one who has not had their flu shot. And then it sends a third one maybe 2 weeks later to who has not had their flu shot. If it doesn't take a lot of work and this can automatically be done, who cares if it's only a small rate? Who cares if it's only a small increase in the proportion of individuals getting the flu shot? It's still a proportion of the individuals getting the flu shot over a large scope population. I believe this would be beneficial. Now, if this takes work, if this takes a lot of time and emailing and constant going back and forth, then it's probably not, the bang is not worth the buck here as far as time and effort putting into this. But if you can just hit one button and send it to all your patients, it's already worked into the electronic medical record. This, for me, is a go-to, even though the numbers and the actual benefit we're getting here is so small. And let's do one more article, and then I will end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. And here we go. Sound the horn before this ship sails into the open water of medical literature again. All right, here we go. Last article that I'm going to talk about is titled Persistent Atrial Fibrillation Ablation with Contact Force Sense Catheter, the Prospective Multicenter Precept Trial. This is in Journal of Cardiology Clinical Electrophysiology, May 8th, 2020. This is 380 patients with persistent AFib. They took these 381 individuals with persistent AFib and they said, here we go, this is what we're going to do. We're going to give you an ablation. And then we're going to follow up with you and we're going to see if you are AFib free. No documented 30-second AFib episodes at 15 months. And that is what we're going to look at. And then we're also going to see what your symptoms are, not only on a monitor just to see, are you an AFib, but do you have symptoms of AFib? Do you have these palpitations, maybe the shortness of breath, whatever it may be, whatever your symptoms are? Even if you are an AFib, but you don't have symptoms of AFib, do we necessarily care? So here we go. The efficacy defined as freedom from any documented 30-second atrial fibrillation episode was 62% at 15 months. So basically, you underwent an invasive procedure for AFib. You underwent an ablation for atrial fibrillation, and 40% of the individuals, almost half the individuals at 15 months, still had AFib. But freedom from atrial fibrillation symptoms was 80% at 15 months, meaning that even though 40% of the individuals still had AFib, 20% of those individuals said, I know I'm still having AFib, but I don't have the symptoms anymore, which I suppose is good. You don't want to have AFib symptoms, but I would like to see an ablation, an invasive procedure like ablation, work a little bit better than about 50%. Unfortunately, this seems to be consistent with a lot of ablation studies that I've read. Now, the annoying part to me about the study is that it is not randomized. The patient knows they're getting a very invasive procedure. Just like pure placebo, their symptoms will resolve, especially when the symptoms are subjective. Things like, I'm having palpitations. Well, your palpitations might resolve if you think that you're getting a $50,000 invasive ablation done by a very specialized physician. My other problem is, when you look at the characteristics, the average CHAD VAS score in the study was 2. 2! 65 years old was the mean age, and the average CHAD VAS score was 2. That's like saying, well, our average patient population was 65-year-old male with hypertension and no diabetes, no previous stroke, no heart failure. This is not my patient population. And repeat ablations were performed in 14% of the individuals. But remember, 40% of the individuals still had AFib. And of that 40%, there was half or 20% of the individuals didn't have symptoms anymore. That means 20% of the original 100% were still having AFib and still having symptoms, yet only 14% had repeat ablations. Why would all 20% not undergo repeat ablations? The article is not clear about this, and it makes me question medicine, if you will. And finally, with every up, there's a down. With every in, there's an out. With every time the tide rolls in, it must roll back out. So let's talk about the adverse event rate, because it is not benign. It is not nothing, my friends. You see, within 1 week was 4% of individuals that underwent this procedure had a bad side effect. This included 1.5% of cardiac tamponade. That sounds terrible. Or it sounds worse if you were among the 0.6% that had a stroke or a TIA. That also sounds terrible. But you think that sounds bad? What about the 0.3% that had a diaphragmatic paralysis? No, thank you. And then there was 1% that had vascular complications, and the study was not completely clear on what vascular complications actually meant. So, if you are having a lot of symptoms, if you have severe heart failure with AFib, then I think that there might be a benefit to ablation. Else, you are undergoing an invasive procedure with risk. So tread lightly, my friends, especially when it only works in the semi-healthy CHADS VAS score of 2 individuals just over half the time. If you are more unhealthy, if you have a higher CHADS VAS 2 score, if you have more comorbid conditions, then this likely has a higher failure rate as well as a higher complication rate. It saddens me, even with the great medical advances that we have, but it seems that the old adage of if you go to ablation once, you go to ablation twice, still holds true. And with that, without further ado, let's end this podcast as I've ended everyone before it and quickly cover a couple of the articles that I have talked about today. Here we go. It was the beginning of it. It was a listener email. Go back, listen to episode 51. I completely agree with you. We should probably not be telling all our patients to take antibiotics for a certain amount of time and say, never take them any less amount of time. If you're feeling better, probably just go ahead and stop, but give them the full dose of antibiotics just in case that's what they need. If you look at the COVID information, it is coming in at a million miles an hour. And unfortunately, some companies, some organizations, and maybe even some medical journals have taken advantage of this, and they are not doing their due diligence and following up with a good peer review. They're making up the data, falsifying. Articles are being retracted from The Lancet. This is sad because future investigations and future science is based on previous investigations and previous science. It seriously makes me sick. Naloxone is coming over the counter, and who knew that you actually had to do an FDA-approved trial to get the label of all medications approved for over the counter? I had no idea. This was really neat, and to me, fascinating, interesting that you have to get people to approve the label. I don't know why I thought it was any other way, but I did, and I found this article fascinating. Now, patients need reminders to do almost anything, just like I need a reminder to put my dish in the dishwasher and not inside the sink. Well, if you send out reminders for the flu vaccine, even three reminders only gets you a 0.7% increase in the rates of flu vaccination compared to no reminders, and one reminder gets you a 0.5% increase. This is a very small increase, but if you can make it done in your electronic medical record with no real work for you, this is probably worth it because this is a gain. This is still more people being vaccinated. So for me, this is a win, even though the numbers are very small, as long as it doesn't require a lot of work on your end and it can just be automatically implemented into the electronic medical record. And last but not least, atrial fibrillation. Well, even in a semi-healthy CHA2DS2-VASc score of 2 atrial fibrillation individuals, the failure rate is about 40%, 40 to 50% at 15 months, at a year and a half, not even a year and a half, basically at a year, you're looking at 60% of individuals are succeeding, which means 40% of individuals fail. And don't think that the risk is negligent. 4% of individuals, of these otherwise semi-healthy individuals, had big-time problems such as cardiac tamponade, a stroke, a TIA, diaphragmatic paralysis. Ugh. In the end, I think you should probably just avoid AFib if you can. And if you're having symptoms, if you have AFib and you have heart failure, well, then maybe we should talk about it. But before you go into it, try to maximize all comorbid conditions, because if you ablate once, you ablate twice, my friends. And with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, let's end this thing. So I'm going to end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.